on the web. It's 7 o'clock here in New York. Coming up next, What's Going On with Felipe Luciano.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and give here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, family. How are you? This is What's Going On with Felipe Luciano, and we do this every Thursday. We discuss topics of interest nationally, internationally, and of course locally. Just got in from LA, and I got in at about 2 in the morning. I don't know how people do this every day or every week, because it taxes your system. I know actors who do this all of the time, and of course businessmen. It's not something for the weak of heart, or the weak of body for that matter. How are you? How have you been? Let me just tell you a little bit. Today we're going to have a discussion with a woman named Emma Frances Snyder, the director of a documentary that is knocking people out. It's a documentary on the takeover of Lincoln Hospital done 50 years ago by the Young Lords, a group that, of course, I headed and was also co-founder of. It is an amazing documentary, and I think when you listen to her, you will understand how important it was to her and how important it was for her to get the message out. We had a wonderful time in L.A. I needed to decompress. I needed to just calm down. And L.A. is a very funny town. I'm switching now. I'm going to the L.A. thing. First of all, the food is fantastic. It is fantastic. The vegetables, the fruit. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you something. I have never had as many fresh vegetables as I had in L.A. The difference is in the crispiness of the lettuce, the snap of the beans. The wonton soup was incredible. First of all, the Asian food there is phenomenal. I met Armenians, loads of them. Not Kardashian, by the way, but loads of them. Very good-looking people, very interesting people. They're involved in all aspects of business, a lot of them in land, a lot of them in real estate. It was wonderful even working out with them. It is a physical culture state, in that you want to stay in shape. The sun is out. You want to make sure that your body's in shape. And even though I've had some physical drawbacks, I was able to go to gym and work out a little bit. And I'm going to continue doing it here. There is the desire just to be better from a health standpoint. The sun does that to you. I had a wonderful time. And I had a wonderful time coming back. It was just L.A. is very different. Like, what they're not used to is people approaching them on the streets. I talk to everybody, as you know. And if you don't know, I'll tell you. And they were a little taken aback by the fact that, hey, how are you? What's happening? What happened was, as soon as they got engaged, as soon as I reached out to them, they were willing to talk, but they're not used to it at all. There is a peace there, folks. There is a peace. Where I was in Burbank, was a place where people are not afraid to walk the streets. First of all, you don't see them out at night as much because it's a community of families, of homeowners. So you don't see oil renters, but you don't feel that fear. And that was important for me because here in New York, though I know East Harlem and though I've been in New York all my life, there is an apprehension. when you're on the streets. There's a sort of a nervous energy. That nervous energy, which some people call the edge, is not present in LA, at least not where I was. So that's it. I'm back, and I'm ready to rock and roll. Again, let me tell you, this film was done, the documentary was dramatized. In other words, Emma took, Miss Snyder took the events of that day, and she hired or obtained people who wanted to act in the film. It was absolutely stunning. And when those lords looked at it, we thought that if you look at it, and she'll tell you how you can gain access to it, when you look at it, you think that you're actually watching the actual takeover. It's amazing. It is an amazing state of affairs. All right, let's not waste any time. I want to give you a clip, just a little clip of the first part of the film, and give you a, before we go back into talking to Emma Snyder. Let's hear one of the clips of the film. First of all, before, it just shows you how easy I am these days. First, let's go to Pacifica, the Pacifica News Foundation, and get news of the day.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is the first key step toward moving our entire freight, transportation, and logistical supply chain nationwide to a 24/7 system.
President Biden announced Wednesday the Port of Los Angeles will begin 24/7 operations to address supply chain bottlenecks. He said the port has nearly doubled its hours of operation. A squeezed global supply chain and a truck driver shortage have led to shortages of computer chips, appliances, and other consumer goods, increasing price tags. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
These commitments will move more goods faster, including toys, just in case you were wondering, appliances, my kids are, and furniture that Americans purchased online or at their local small businesses.
Vice President Kamala Harris met Wednesday with the Prime Minister of Barbados, Mia Motley, who talked about strengthening the Caribbean region's relationship with the U.S. on climate change, combating drug trafficking, and human rights.
There is much that we can work together on, looking to see where both countries can help each other. We have traditionally provided persons who have come here to work.
The Supreme Court Wednesday appeared poised to reinstate a death sentence for Jahar Tsarnaev, convicted of helping carry out the 2013 Boston Marathon bombings. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
They agreed he was guilty. Their only claim was, don't give me the death penalty because it's my brother who is the moving force.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in Boston upheld Tsarnaev's convictions, but ruled his death sentence could be overturned because the trial judge had not questioned the jurors closely enough about their exposure to pretrial publicity and excluded evidence concerning Tamerlan Tsarnaev, his older brother and accomplice. A House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack subpoenaed Jeffrey Clark, a Trump ally and former Justice Department employee, who urged its leaders to investigate former President Trump's election fraud claims. Experts say the move indicates the committee's interest in learning more about how Trump attempted to pressure top officials over the election during his final days in office. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical advisor, said Wednesday more employers should implement vaccine mandates.
So, I mean, we don't like to be telling people what they need to do with regard to vaccines, but we know that mandates work.
Two new analyses suggest the 2020 census may have undercounted Black Americans at a significantly higher rate than usual, anywhere from 3 to 10 times greater than a decade ago, raising concerns about whether minority communities could lose out on fair representation and funding. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
For WBAI in New York, I'm Yesenia Moreno reporting on a recent Latinx festival in Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Brujeria Festival comes alive about mid-afternoon with the rhythmic sounds of the Caribbean drums filling the Dumbo Archway. A crowd claps in unison around a collective of dancers wearing long, flowing skirts. and single-file lines begin to form along the wall, where tarot card readers have set up stations at small tables. The festival was founded by New York City performance artist Chiquita Brujita. Her name loosely translates to Little Witch, and she is a third-generation Regla de Ocha, or Santeria practitioner. But Chiquita says, in this case, brujería doesn't translate to witchcraft. Instead, the Brooklyn Brujería Festival is about channeling the magic of Brooklyn, and in doing so, honoring the spiritualism in Latinx culture that is rooted in African and indigenous practices.
When you come and beat drums, like, this ties us back to practices of communication that were used forever to grieve, to nourish the spirit, to celebrate, to literally call to war, to call to feast, right? So when we shift our vibration with the drum, it takes us to a feeling that humans have been having for a very long time. And I think that that's powerful.
Two festival goers, Erica Jackson and Monica Mina, describe what the festival's purpose means to them.
To be in a community of people that have the same strength and faith and spirituality, where you could feel safe and protected.
Absolutely. Like the diversity, just the inclusion. We really just want to be in a place where you could celebrate your culture.
For Chiquita, this sense of belonging and inclusion is intentional.
This is not about Santeria specifically or anything like that. It's about what is our Brooklyn magic. It calls to the people who are in these spaces, but it also calls to people who identify in Brujas in a whole new way.
Near the festival's end, Chiquita approaches the line of performers, the drums, and bows to them, lifting her full yellow skirt off the floor as she lowers. A little girl about 6 years old darts into the arena next to her. She begins to dance freely, erratically, until others join. Joy moves through the throngs of people, the train above them rumbling past into the night. For WBAI in New York, I'm Yesenia Moreno.
Good morning, how are you? This is Felipe Luciano. The program is called What's Going On, and today we're focusing on an event that took place 50 years ago, the takeover of Lincoln Hospital. And it was documented by a young woman named Emma Frances Snyder, who's on the air with us right now. There has been an incredible surge in the interest of political and cultural affairs 50 years ago. Puerto Rican youth are beginning to respond to their identity and the identity crisis that many of us are going through. They are trying to figure out what happened. What motivated you to do that? How can we achieve that state of mind that says we are who we are, and we'll stand for it, we'll confront anybody who gets in our way, we will support our people, we'll defend our people. That is happening across the nation, I have found out. With me today is Emma Frances Snyder, who was the documentarian who actually did this. It took her 10 years, ladies and gentlemen, to put this documentary together. How are you? And good morning, Ms. Snyder.
Good morning, Felipe. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me something, Emma. What motivated you to do this film, Takeover? And we'll let people know where they can access it. But what led you to do this film?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been an activist for a large portion of my life. And I was actually studying at Brooklyn College when they implemented tuition increases and cut services, and the group that I was organizing with attempted to occupy the president's office, and it went rather poorly, and a few of us got arrested, and and there was, you know, a lot. They knew we were coming, and so at that point, I was like, I need to learn more. I need to learn. I need to be better. And I started studying with Jean Theo Harris, actually, independent study about the civil rights and the Black Power movement. And that's when I came across Palante, actually, the book that you all wrote in the 70s. And I was so blown away. I think at first it was because the organization I was working with was organizing based on the principles that you and the Black Panthers had in the 70s, or had at least discussed in the 70s, and that totally blew me away, because I wasn't even aware of that. And then as I continued my research, just around the concept of health care and the idea that you, the Young Lords, and obviously the Black Panthers as well, were so young. I mean, the youngest being maybe 12, like confirmed 14 to 21, were organizing around access to quality health care. And in my mind, I was pretty, well, not only blown away that young, like very young people were organizing around something that I think it's hard to describe, but, you know, the concept of healthcare being a right, not a privilege, but at that time, maybe that language wasn't necessarily in the mainstream, but just organizing around the health of people, and then how successful you were. And that was really my starting point, was learning from successful movements, and then also finding my place in the larger movement in the U.S., right? I was part of the student movement, but I was also, you know, I have been organizing and, you know, I've been an activist for a while and trying to find my place. And I
Well, it took us not too long to figure out that health was a revolutionary issue. It was the issue of the time, and I talk to people about this all of the time. About 50 years ago, when we were organizing, we were trying to figure out, we had started out as a student organization, La Sociedad de Albizu Campos, the Society of Albizu Campos, who happens to be our Malcolm X. And we would go into the streets and ask the elders what did they think was important as an issue, because we wanted to focus on their needs. I thought they were going to say police brutality. I was ready for it, ready to fight, jump on the barricades, to die if need be. And they said, calm down. What we need is you to pick up the garbage. And I said, the garbage? That's where we need help. The garbage is on the streets all the time. They come, they pick it up. Half of it is thrown on the streets, or they don't pick it up. Well, Emma, I flipped out. I wanted to resign right there. I wanted to leave the party, the organization. I'm not going to fight for garbage. It took me time to understand that what the elders were saying is that this is the beginning of disease. This is where it all starts. And if you're not willing to help with issues like this, how can you begin to talk about the independence of Puerto Rico or self-determination for Puerto Ricans and blacks here and people of color in the United States? What are you talking about? So we started sweeping up the streets. That's where it started. The health issue started there. Later on, we evolved into TB and all of the other stuff. But tell me something. Where are you from? Who are you? Give people a sense of your bio.
Yeah. So I grew up in Westchester, so just outside of the city, and actually the Bronx, we share the same representative, right, which is complicated. The Northern Bronx, rather. And I grew up in a very political household. My dad is from Trenton, New Jersey, and was drafted into the Vietnam War and became radicalized from there. And my mom is British. So I grew up with the understanding and the notion that education should be free, healthcare should be free, and that I have a responsibility to the collective, right? Like there's a social contract, and I have a role to play in said contract. And that's, you know, I've seen my mom, like,
stop traffic and let, like, ducks cross the road. And, you know, I mean, like, I know it sounds silly, but, like, you know, really always doing the thing. Because if you don't do it, who's going to do it, right? That's always been...
That's the point. That's the point of any radical. If you don't do it, who's going to do it?
Yeah.
If it's not you, then who?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I've always taken that responsibility pretty seriously because I've seen it put into, I've seen what it looks like in my daily life, right? It's like stopping someone, making a scene, you know, never being too afraid to make a scene. But, you know, getting older, you try to choose your battles, right?
Right.
So I think that I've put a lot of that energy, I mean, we've talked about this before, but the idea of righteous indignation, right? And so I put a lot of that energy into this film. Like I think I put all of it into it.
All right, but let's tell the audience what, and I'd like to know, what caused you to dramatize the takeover? What was that about? How did you reach that decision? And then we're going to we're going to listen to a clip of the film, it's of the documentary itself. What led you to dramatize it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, like, I think real life is very interesting, and I'm inspired by it, obviously, what you did. And then as someone that was part of an occupation or an attempted one or activism in general, it takes a lot of emotion. It takes a lot of bravery and courage to do this. There is so much emotion and energy and drama in a takeover. Like, there's not, it's a movie. It's a movie. and that was kind of what inspired me. And then at the same time, wanting to make something that was empowering, and entertaining for younger people, right? I have the attention span of a fly. I am of this millennial generation, the internet, like, I have a short attention span, and I like to be entertained, and I love action movies. So how do I bring those things together, and how do I show history as it was, right? Like, I think that films can kind of gloss over the most dramatic elements, and it's like, what, let's sit in these moments and live and breathe in them, and, like, That's all I can say. It's just like, let's sit with this. Like, this is a lot. Like, there's so much.
Well, you certainly did that. I mean, even the veterans who watched the film, people who were there, were amazed at the authenticity. That's what you get from that documentary. It's called Takeover, ladies and gentlemen. Takeover. The authenticity of the dramatization is beautiful. Let's hear a clip from a part of the film, and then we'll come back to the interview. We'll be getting call-ins. We'll be asking you to call in just a minute, but let's hear a clip from the film.
One of the things that begins to develop in our community is a high incidence of tuberculosis, and we began to see it as an epidemic.
The way the TB testing works, the Young Lords would go out every Saturday. A couple of days later, you had to go check. So if it was positive, then you needed to get an X-ray to confirm whether or not you actually had TB. So, of course, we didn't have an X-ray machine.
The city had this huge TB truck, an X-ray mobile TB truck.
But where they assigned the TB testing truck to go was an affluent area where probably no one had TB.
What we then decided to do was we were going to take over the truck. So the truck parks. We took over the truck. We put the two technicians in the back of the truck. I was in the cabin of the truck. Now, mind you, the technicians, they initially were very scared. I mean, this was a takeover. They were being kidnapped, basically, for all practical purposes. Once we got to the place and they saw the number of people lined up, they just stayed there all day. They gave great statements to the press. The technicians said that they had never x-rayed as many people as they had that day.
By nightfall, when people stopped coming, the police came and took the truck. But we'd already made the point that there was a tuberculosis problem the city was not addressing.
We had established a certain level of fame and respect in the community.
We also learned that doing actions on a Sunday, you'd get news.
Let me just let you know that those are the voices of the actual Lords, Denise Oliver, Mickey Melendez. It was an amazing time. It was an amazing time to be part of it. And I am always amazed that we put our lives on the line so many times. The amazing thing about youth is that when you are enraged and your hackles go up, you decide to do something about it. There is a certain bravery, a courage. Courage is not this sort of bombastic, I'm going to hurt you, I'm going to fight against you. It's just, no, I'm not going to allow this to happen. And that's what happened with the Young Lords. God bless them. God bless them. Mm-hmm. Emma Snyder, we're going to be asking for phone. Let me just give people the telephone number to call. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. And that's to give us a sense of your interest in this documentary. Emma, it took you 10 years. What did that entail?
Well, you know, that's a great question. You know, so I am a first-time filmmaker, so I don't have a track record per se. So I think that also, that had to do with it. Mm-hmm. It does take people a long time to make these films. Decade of Fire took 10 years. Palante, Siempre Palante took Iris, a young Lord herself, 10 years.
Yes.
Rainbow Coalition took the director 13 years. So it's not unheard of, but it does take, and I think the more you find out about the stories, the more it allows you to like hold on a little bit longer, knowing that it took others longer as well. But it really, it's a great question. And the first time I received money, which was, I think, like funding, was, I think, 5 years in. And there was part of me that was like, I don't even know how I held on to this. I don't even know how I kept pushing this forward for so long.
Well, where did you find the money to do it? How did you take your own money?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, that was, I first started out when I was in Brooklyn College, right? So I had most of the labor and the acting was done by students and for free because we were all supporting each other in school. And so the cost, and I got most of the equipment for free because it started off as a thesis film. And then at that point, I had friends in film. So it was kind of like a bartering system. Like we supported each other. And, you know, I would buy lunch and that type of thing. So you feed each other and you just help keep it moving. So that was, you know, that was how the first round of recreations got started. And then, I mean, really everything kind of turned around when I met Tony Gerber and Lynn Nottage of Market Road Films. They, I mean, you know, Lynn Nottage is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning playwright. Tony Gerber is a director in his own right and an Emmy Award Emmy Award-winning producer as well, or director. And so they really helped me. They helped me with the language, you know, because writing grants, there's a specific type of language you need to use. They had already, like, their track record and their belief in me and the story helped others believe in it. So that's actually really when things turned around, absolutely. And when things started moving on a more quote unquote professional level. I mean, professional, yes, as well. Absolutely.
This is WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. We're listening to Emma Frances Snyder, who directed a film, a documentary, I should add, about the Young Lords and the takeover of Lincoln Hospital. And the number here to call if you want to join us in the conversation is 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. I don't think those of you listening, I don't think you understand really, unless you've been involved in radical movements, how serious the situation was in the 60s. I mean, we were being slaughtered. We were being slaughtered by police. We were being slaughtered by the FBI, those in the radical movement. We were being slaughtered. We had already seen what happened to King, to Malcolm, to the Kennedy brothers. This was serious business. And we wanted to make our statement. We wanted to make our stand here. We were about to let this happen. I was with the Last Poets before the Young Lords. And the last poets were Abby O'Doon, Guy Lin Kane, David Nelson, Nalaja at that time. I wasn't about to just sit and read poetry. I had been listening to Amiri Baraka, had become his mentee, if you will, where he would always cajole us and declare, poems have to be bullets. And I took that seriously. I ended up going into the Young Lords reluctantly a bit, because in the beginning when I thought about it, when they approached me, I did not want to do it. I said, listen, I'm a poet. And as much as I am involved in black revolutionary movements, I was involved first in black nationalism in the cultural movement, and then I went to revolutionary nationalism, which is a whole other thing. And then I said, but they're not ready. You're not ready to do this. I had never seen a situation other than in gangs where Puerto Ricans were willing to stand up and throw down. I just didn't see it. And so why do this? We had tried this in 1950 in Puerto Rico, and it had failed. Not that it failed miserably, but it failed a valiant effort. But it never went anywhere. Of course, we can talk about the Massacre de Ponce in 1937, where we moved against the government. My grandmother was part of that, because we wanted independence. But be that as it may, there was very little activity on the part of Puerto Ricans here in the United States to rebel against United States and the American domination of the island of Puerto Rico. So for me, this affirmation, this joining the Young Lords, Emma, was my way of saying it ain't gonna happen on my watch. It just isn't. And I'm just so I'm so respectful of you and so happy that you were able to put this this thing together. Again, the number, this documentary together, Takeover, 212-209-2877. What were some of the difficulties in getting this film done? Because I want other filmmakers or aspiring filmmakers to not to be deterred, to keep on pushing to get their ideas on film or on tape.
Yeah, well, I just want to thank you for that. And honestly, this has been I say this very seriously. This has been one of the greatest honors of my life, making this film. And I think that's something, the Young Lords are, I think that you guys are, heroes. I genuinely, am so grateful that I have been, that you and the other Lords in the film and other members of the Lords that are not in the film have been so trusting with your story, and I think that's something that I am so grateful for. And I think that one of the things is with documentary film, especially if it's your first film, you have to absolutely love and believe in what you're doing 1,000%, because you will be tested every single step of the way. And you have to, this is something that you have to live with day in, day out, for the past 10 years, and then who knows for how long, right? And so that's the biggest thing. You have to believe in what you're doing, and you have to love it. And I truly believe 100% in what the Young Lords did and are still doing, and still believe that you all hold the answers to the problems of healthcare today. Everything that's in that film is still relevant to today. And that was one of the things that kept me moving, because I was this is fundamentally one of the most important, I feel, fundamentally one of the most important pieces of American history that is missing from our consciousness. And honestly, I think that a lot of white people do not understand the rights that we have that came from the struggle of black people, Puerto Ricans, and other people of color in this country. And that is one of the biggest reasons why I was working on this, because we are connected. Well, all of us are connected in this country through imperialism and colonialism. And we need to honor the work that has been done, especially white people need to honor the work that has been done to get us the rights that we have. Rights are not given to people, they are fought for. And so that has been the biggest thing for me. And then in terms of health and health care, if you don't have your health, you don't have anything. You can't work. We live in a capitalist society. You can't work. You can't pay your bills. You can't show up. You can't fight, right? If you're sick and you don't have the means to pay for it, and you can't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anybody. And so that was the biggest thing for me, the realization of the importance of health and health care and the connection that you all made when you were like 14 to 21, right? And so for me, I just wanted to lift it up and push it forward, right? So that there is now, the Young Lords are talking about health care, free health care on the New York Times. And it is, I don't actually have numbers. They don't release them. But I would say that it is like being watched.
What do you mean by that on the New York Times? We were put on the New York Times. What do you mean by that exactly?
I just mean the film Takeover is on the New York Times. It's on the front page.
Go ahead, girl.
OpDocs, opinionated documentary, the Takeover was acquired by the New York Times, the opinionated documentary section. And so that's where it is right now, and that's where it's going to live. It's free forever for anyone that has internet. You don't need to, there's no paywall. And so that this story is now on the New York Times, like the Young Lords.
How can people access it? What do they, is there a sort of a code that they can reach or they can key into?
You can follow Takeover the Film on Instagram and Twitter. All of our links to the New York Times, all of the links are there, but you can watch Takeover on YouTube. With Spanish subtitles, and Takeover on the New York Times website, and all of the links are connected to our social media.
Okay.
And 212-209-287.
I'm sorry, I'm stepping on you.
No,
I didn't mean to.
No, keep going.
212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. What's amazing to me about this film family, this documentary, is that we were so young. When Emma says 14 to 21, she is serious. That's how old we were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same age that these kids are out here shooting each other, joining gangs. There was a reason for us. We had a reason to get up in the morning. I had a reason to get out there and put my face in front of cops and chant with all of my other comrades. All of us did. What a wonderful thing it is to get up knowing that you're providing a part of it. More than that, that you are meaningful, that you're giving yourself affirmation. It is such a wonderful thing to get up and say, I'm going to be with comrades. I'm going to be with 50 men and women who are serious about either housing, education, gender abuse, whatever it is. We are here and we're going to do it. It is an exhilarating feeling to get up in the morning because it's not work. It was not work for us. It was a mission. 212-209-2877 to talk about the documentary Takeover. Let's hear another clip from this doc. This is the clip where Cleo Silver, who was one of the great Young Lords, an African-American sister. I should add to you that the Young Lords was one-third African-American. So we did not have the separation that we see happening today even between blacks and Latinos. We didn't believe it. We were raised with black folk. We are black. So we didn't get caught up in that nonsense. No, que no somos negro. We're not like them. No, we had changed. The black arts movement had taken care of that. We were all African-based. We knew who we were, and we knew where we had to go with this. This is a clip that gives you some sense, at least from an audio standpoint, of how we approached authority. And what Cleo Silvers goes in and tells the guy, you got to go.
I was a third year resident at Lincoln in July of 1970. I was on call, maybe went to sleep at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I heard this commotion outside. Wasn't sure what it was.
My job was to go into the administrator's office and to ask the administrators to leave.
Mr.
asking for these changes to take place here in the South Bronx at Lincoln Hospital for over a year, and you've paid no attention to us, and you've called the cops on us, so now we're putting you out. You've taken over the hospital. We're going to run it. You're out. I will walk you to your car.
We made it clear that there was a new administration. And to accentuate who we were, we put a Puerto Rican flag, a giant Puerto Rican flag outside the hospital.
And a sign that said, Lincoln Hospital, the People's Hospital.
Wonderful time to be alive. That was the voice of Carlos Rovira and, of course, Cleo Silver, who were participants in the Lincoln Hospital takeover. My name is Felipe Luciano. We do this every Thursday, What's Going On? And we talk about events of the day and events of the nation, both locally and nationally, internationally as well. I'm on the phone with Emma Frances Snyder, who is the director of this film. It's amazing. She's a young woman, comes out of Westchester. And decided she wanted to take up this campaign, if you will, to highlight and to chronicle the journey of the Young Lords in terms of healthcare. Let me just tell you folks, that those who are listening, that we had to do this in a very surreptitious way. We could not just take over the hospital. What had happened is we had started with TB testing, and we realized that so many of our people did not have the healthcare. Forgive me for not allowing you to speak, Emma. I just want to give a context of it.
No, please, please.
And what we did was we decided that after we heard of the death of a Puerto Rican woman in Lincoln Hospital, you have to understand Lincoln Hospital was a butcher house. We called it the Roach Motel. You went in, but you weren't sure of getting out. You went in, but you didn't come out. And so many people had been fighting against it. The Think Lincoln Committee, the HRM, Health Revolutionary Unity Movement. And while we were involved in health in terms of garbage in our community, we had not yet moved out of that. And we heard about this woman who died getting a late-term abortion, and we couldn't believe, how could somebody die from that? How is it possible? Lincoln at that point was so decrepit, roaches were in the operating room, sometimes the lights would go out, the air conditioning would go out, paint was peeling off the ceiling. It was horrible. It's just a horrible place to be. And I couldn't understand, we couldn't understand why this was being allowed to continue. So the decision was made to take over the hospital. I must tell you transparently, I was against it. I thought it was too far. Look at how myopic I was. Here we are in Edbatio. I thought, how logistically, how do you get supplies up there? How do you get reinforcements up there? The Central Committee at that time, made up of Yoruba, Pablo Yoruba Guzman, David Perez, Fee Ortiz, myself, and that was it, right? It was Yoruba, David Perez, and of course, myself, and...
Was Juan Gonzalez part of the Central Committee
at the time?
What
was that, Juan Emma? Gonzalez? I completely forgot him. Juan Gonzalez, major part of the organization, and Juan Fiortiz were there, and they decided, no, you're wrong. I wanted to take over Mount Sinai. They said, no, that's not going to work. It would create so many problems for us because our own community would be against us. So why don't we go to the more glaring contradiction, which was Lincoln Hospital, and that's exactly what happened. Forgive me, Juan, didn't mean to omit you from our historical ruminations here. So we did it, and it worked. It only worked for a day. We didn't want to take it over and fight inside that institution, but we did want to make a point, and we did, especially in terms of the press. So we found a guy, a gentleman, who was part of District 65, and Willie Rodriguez, and he said, "I'll drive you there," in a big U-Haul truck. And we got everybody together on Broadway in the 80s. I can't remember where the house was. I think it was in the 80s. And we got everybody, they thought we were going to a party. We told people, you can't call, you can't say anything. We got everybody together, about 30 people, and we put them all in a truck, lined up. It was like D-Day. Just thinking about it is exciting to me. And we filed out of that truck about 4 in the morning. The security guards were taken off guard, and we were able to take the hospital. Might I just add a little historical footnote? We had trained so hard. We had trained in cardio. We had trained in everything. We were ready. Guys were running around the Central Park, Mirror Lake. That by the time we got there, we were ready physically. We took that hospital, which was an 11-story nurse's residence. We took that hospital in 7 minutes. Can you believe? Guys running, men and women running up to the 11th floor and taking it. And by 15, we had the building secure. That's what that was about. And, of course, they went in and mm-hmm. told the administrator, who was not Puerto Rican, to leave. Emma, what else can you add to this?
I mean, I think you did a great job. I mean, I love hearing, and this is some of the pieces that are not in the film, was what you just talked about, where how you, the logistical conversations of, like, which hospital to take over, why not to take over, why not Mount Sinai, why mm-hmm. Lincoln Hospital. I mean, I think that, like, I mean, this was part of the reason that I was interested in speaking to you guys. And I don't know, it started out as a student film, but I was like, how did you do it? Like, how did you do it? Tell me beat by beat. And, like, the more I found out, the more I was like, are you joking? Like, this is crazy. Like, it's like everyone, you got like 50 people in the back of a truck and drove to Lincoln Hospital. I mean, like, tell me this isn't a movie, you know? But it's also,
well, you made it into also, one.
Well, exactly. That's what I mean. It's like, it's right there. There's so much drama and excitement, and like the reality of the actual takeover is pretty incredible. And the planning, the logistics, I mean, that is also a huge part of the conversation that I didn't get into. I didn't have a chance to get into because it is a short film, but like what went into the planning, right? How you did it. I mean, you had the security, the defense team,
ministry,
not the right word, ministry, thank you so much. Yeah. The defense team, defense ministry, scouting Lincoln Hospital, making, like, checking.
For months.
Yes.
We had men and women out there, aided by mm-hmm. people who had been fighting this battle for months and even years. Walter Bosque, Cleo Silvas, and a bunch of people had been fighting this fight for a long time. There were several guys who were sent to scout out. One of them was Huey Escamberlain, who's a master martial artist. And he's into Tiger Claw. Pai, Jose Diaz, and T, we call him T. Gabriel Torres, they had been sent to pave the way for us, and they did. Mickey Melendez was part of that, too. In fact, you know, the funny thing is, when we were talking about Mickey Melendez and the TB truck, you heard his voice on the air. Our major problem with taking over the TB truck, this is before Lincoln Hospital, and doing the TB, is we had nobody who could drive stick shift. That was our major problem. Mickey was the only one who could do it. And of course, he takes it and he swerves around a corner at one point in the Bronx and in Manhattan and knocks over a Piragua truck, an icy truck. You know, shaved ice. You ever seen that? The Piragua trucks?
Yeah. No, I know.
Well, he knocked one over. Mm-hmm. He knocked one over. Do you know that he went back and paid the guy $75?
I know. He did. But it was $50, right?
$60, something like that. And it's amazing. It just shows the character of the personnel of the people involved at that time. And I, again, want to compliment you for having put this film together. It's absolutely crucial. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break now. Before we leave, I want to talk more, get one more piece out. And then you give people a sense of where they can get this film, where they can access it. The number here to call is 212-209-2877. We don't have that much time. 212-209-2877. Let's hear another piece of this film. This is when we decided, when the cops had surrounded. And ladies and gentlemen, When they surrounded Lincoln Hospital on the Brooklyn's Road, they had armored personnel carriers. They had Stoner assault guns that can go through 3 feet of concrete. They had, it seems, the entire Bronx Tactical Force out there. It was unbelievable. I figured, okay, this is it. They sent Barry Goddard and Sid David off to negotiate with us. And they said, you guys got to leave because, you know, you can get hurt. And we said, well, our blood is on your hands. As it turns out, we were willing to stand and defend our right to free health. Here's an interesting thing. I was in L.A. yesterday. The day before that, I was going to an Israeli place to get some food, some hummus, some falafel, some chicken, some lamb. And that was yesterday, I'm sorry. And I meet a man named Jeffrey. And he just walks in and he starts to talk. And I start to talk to him. I don't have to tell our audience. I'm very, very familiar. I'm very close to Jewish culture. And I love it. So I'm sitting there talking to him. And he says, you know, I'm a patients' rights advocate. And I stood with my mouth open. I said, are you serious? He said, well, why do you say that? I said, because I've been there for 50 years. And we started to talk and bond over the issue of patient rights. You know, the Young Lords were the first ones to put together a patient's right bill. And I told him, and he said, you mean you are the guys who made that happen? Here I am 3,000 miles away, 50 years later. This guy is 72 years of age, and he's talking about it as if it's the greatest thing. And I'm standing there thinking, my God, look at what we did. Anyway, I'm talking to Emma Frances Snyder, who directed a documentary called Takeover. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to see this film. You have to see it. It's unbelievable. We'll give you some access to it. And just let's put the last clip on now.
The deputy mayor finally said, look, the police want to come in here. We're trying to keep them out. We cannot announce that we're going to build a new Lincoln Hospital. But I give you my word that if you leave, we'll build a hospital. We'll build a new hospital.
I don't like people to be too optimistic.
We were skeptical.
Kind of pessimist,
you know? Never once did we put down our guard and begin to trust them.
So we had to make a decision at that point. Well, do we stay in here and force the mayor's hand and have the police come in? Or do we figure out a way to declare a victory and leave?
The cops began to mobilize.
And someone came up with the great idea of giving us scrub coats and stethoscopes.
They surrounded the hospital, but there was one exit that they had not covered.
It was the hour where the workers and patients were also going home. So we blended in with the patients and the hospital staff that was leaving the building.
We walked out in between the police cars, which had lined up around the hospital. So, yes, just walked by like nothing's happening, but you're scared to death.
And when they got in, there was no one. There was no one left.
The PS to this story is that 6 years later, a new hospital was built. It stands on 149th Street in the Bronx, in the South Bronx. It may not be the best. People still criticize it, but it's so much better than what we had. My name is Felipe Luciano. We're discussing Takeover, the documentary of the takeover of Lincoln Hospital in 1970. Emma, where can people get this film? We got to cut out now. Where can people get this film? How could they get it again?
Yeah, so if you follow us on Instagram and Twitter, Takeover the Film, you can find all of the links. You can also just Google OpDocs, O-P-D, as in dog, O-C-S, Takeover, And it's streaming on the New York Times website for free behind no paywall. So it's available and accessible to everyone with the internet.
I want to thank you very much, Emma Frances Snyder, for giving us some perspective on this documentary and hopefully inspiring other young filmmakers to use their optical knowledge to record history. I also want to thank Mickey Melendez, David Perez, Pablo Yoruba Guzman, Juan Fiortis, Denise Oliver, Iris Morales, Carlos Rovira, Gabriel Torres, we call him T, Carl Pastor, many, all of the people, and Walter Bosque and Cleo Silvas, who were instrumental in keeping us abreast of the latest affairs that were going on, the negotiations that were going on with Lincoln Hospital. And Arne Segarra, by the way, who helped us, who helped minimize the destruction from the city on this. He was the Hispanic aide to Mayor Lindsay at the time. Take care of yourselves. We'll see you next Thursday. God bless you.
Right on. Right on. 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. What's going on today with Felipe Luciano? Tomorrow at 7 a.m. Johanna Fernandez. A new day. Thanks so much for tuning in. Coming up at 8 will be Democracy Now!, but right now, stay tuned for the local station board candidate statements.
This is WBAI New York. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 27 listener candidates.
Hello, fellow listeners. My name is Errol Maitland. Some of you may associate me with programs named Emanation, Wake Up Call, and Democracy Now! I plead guilty. WBAI and the entire Pacifica network must be preserved and strengthened because it cannot be duplicated or replaced. We must invest in growth through partnership in order to press our message of peace and justice. I am committed to ensuring that WBAI respects its listeners and that we become intergenerational again.
I want WBAI to do more and be more, and I'm willing to work for it. I'm Bunupti Kamenthu, known to many as Jeff Monroe. I'm passionate about WBAI and appreciative of the education that I have had here. I would like regular coverage of the full listening area, which goes beyond the five boroughs. There are issues and concerns in northern New Jersey, on Long Island, and definitely in Westchester and Rockland counties that warrant the WBAI treatment. We too support the station and its mission. I have experience in community access TV and would like to help create systems of meaningful outreach.
My name is Nick Nicoloudis. I'm an adjunct professor at CUNY. I believe in the power of community radio to inform and reflect the community's values and politics. And I'm running for the local station board to support the mission of WBAI, to give a voice to the community who supports it and to build a powerful network of listeners, supporters, and allies to keep WBAI publicly owned.
I am Catherine O'Sullivan, and I'm a performing artist. I get involved. I believe in preserving our independent, diverse, uncensored voices on WBAI and the wider Pacifica network. I'm opposed to giving up any of our independence. We must keep working on our financial stability, completing audits in a timely fashion, getting grants, and fundraising. I'm Catherine O'Sullivan. Vote for me and my colleagues running on the Indy slate.
This is Hazel Pinder, and I am a local station board member. I'm running again because I believe that a strong BAI is essential and has played a significant role in building diverse radical movements. WBAI has contributed to my own education on social justice issues. I'm a retired school teacher who often incorporated some of the programming into my lessons. I want to help build a brighter future for WBAI, and with your vote, I will be an advocate for growth and change.
Matthew Rice here, R-E-I-S-S. I cover the rackets, sham elections, aborted democracies, news, sports, and weather. I was a preschool student in AOC's district when less than 1% of America protested and ended the Vietnam War, thanks to TV coverage. Today, however, the media does not question authority. The task falls exclusively to BAI. Fortunately, the BAI electorate may be the most capable political cadre this side of the border.
To learn more about WBAI's local station board candidates and